This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming today, former Louisiana Democratic Executive Director Trey Orso, now a prominent political consultant locally and nationally, will square off with Republican activist Scott McKay of the Hayride. They exchange views on state and national issues. Journalist Mark Ambinder will reflect on a close call 35 years ago in 1983, the U.S. and the Soviet Union weighed the prospect of a nuclear exchange. Ambinder's book is The Brink. And Advocate Bureau Chief Mark Ballard is here to talk about qualifying for the Secretary of State election, the vacancy created by the resignation of Tom Shedler, as well as the controversy on the Metro Council. And Governor John Bel Edwards faced a battery of Bayou Bridge protesters yesterday as he tried to do his radio show. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. In studio is Trey Orso, the former executive director of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Trey is now a prominent consultant with his partner Michael Baychok, and they handle candidates all over the country, issues of importance. And a few years ago, in the year of 2015, they were involved with a group called Gumbo Pack, and they were front and center in making sure that David Vitter did not become governor. And in that successful quest, Trey was named the National Political Consultant of the Year. Yesterday, we heard from Roger Villery, the former head of the Republican Party, who's now a political consultant of note. And, of course, Roger was bullish about President Trump, and says the Republican Party will do everything it can to unseat John Bel Edwards in 2019, as in next year. Trey Orso, let's start there. How do you see the governor's election evolving?
Well, it really hasn't evolved much at all thus far, since there's no opposition. I know that the Republican Party would like to find a candidate and coalesce around somebody, and they're, the names that keep popping up that you read about in the paper or online. But Governor Edwards has been doing an excellent job leading the state and digging us out of the hole that Bobby Jindal left behind, the $2 billion budget deficit that Jindal left when he left office. And he's been working really hard on that, and the economy's doing better. We're economic development gains. And so I think the Republicans are just having a hard time trying to figure out who is going to step up and take him on. So the actual campaign or the race itself is, I think, a little under 15 months away from the election, hasn't really evolved. And I listened to the show yesterday when the governor was on your program yesterday afternoon, and I think the point he made has been consistent throughout his term, that his game plan, so to speak, or his the way he's approaching things is just to be the best governor that he can be and do the best job that he can, and to be present and in the moment and focused on the job he's doing for the people of Louisiana. And then the election will take care of itself. And so that's what he's doing.
What about the prospect of Senator Kennedy running against him?
Well, that prospect is there, of course. John Kennedy has been running for offices continuously since, I believe, 1991 was the first time he started running. And he finally got elected to the U.S. Senate a couple of years ago, and he's up there. He doesn't seem to pay a whole lot of attention to the job as Senate. He seems to pay more attention to local stuff back here. Look, that, who knows what he's going to do. If he runs, we'll be ready for him. But I don't know. I mean,
well, he's run for many offices, as we know. In fact, he, in 2003, jumped in the governor's race and ultimately backed out when Bobby Jindal became a candidate. But right now, he's the big Republican and is probably keeping other Republicans from getting in the race. But, Trey, we're a year and 2.5 months away from the primary. So if John Kennedy is going to run, he probably needs to make up his mind and announce sooner than later.
I think Kennedy probably has a little bit more of a luxury of higher name recognition than some of the other people. So he probably has the luxury of waiting a little longer than some of the others, perhaps. And, of course, he's not on the ballot this fall. So, you know, he has a little bit more time. But, you know, I think a lot of the people that supported him for Senate and put up a whole lot of money to get him there and recognize the value that seniority has in Congress might prefer that he stick to the job that he has and actually focus on it a little bit than to try and keep jumping back and forth from one job to another. But that's a decision he's going to have to make.
Well, Senator Kennedy is a man who is a media magnet, not magnate, but magnet. He draws a lot of attention on Capitol Hill with his quips. And in the state, he often puts out press releases. For example, he called for John Bel Edwards recently to fire an employee at Southern University, something the governor doesn't even have the authority to do. But yet, I haven't heard a word from Senator Kennedy over the last few days about President Trump and the Helsinki summit. What do you make of this as far as the silence from our congressional delegation?
Well, he really was very quiet for a while, which is amazing since he had just returned from a trip to Russia himself over the 4th of July, which was widely panned by people around the country and especially by the Russian press, too. So since Senator Kennedy seems to have a one-liner for everything, it was amazing that he didn't have much to say about the president's press conference with President Putin. And then he finally did come out a day or two ago and said that he thought that the president got a little tangled up with his words, is what Senator Kennedy. I listened to the press conference with President Trump and President Putin. I listened to every word of it. He didn't sound tangled up to me. I mean, he sounded pretty clear in his convictions. Now he, in the 2 days since, has, I guess, tried to fix it and then unfix it and then fix it again. You need some Dramamine for the seasickness for going up and down with this thing. But Senator Kennedy has come out and said that he thinks that the president just got a little tangled up with his words, and those are his words.
Well, Donald Trump got 58% of the votes in 2016 in Louisiana. In some parishes like Livingston, 85%. 85% of the people in Livingston Parish voted for Donald Trump. Now, in East Baton Rouge, Hillary Clinton got almost 60% of the votes. So it is an amazing phenomenon we have. And in some other parishes, believe it or not, the president did even better than he did in Livingston. But you go down these rural areas, and he just cleaned Hillary Clinton's clock in 2016. So for any statewide candidate, Republican or Democrat, they have to compute that as far as any criticism of the president, don't they?
You do. You know, I have the luxury of looking at numbers, polling numbers, probably more than most people do. And I will say that he's still somewhat popular, although not nearly as much as he was a couple years ago here in the state and elsewhere. But almost all of his popularity rests within registered Republicans. I mean, the president is a very polarizing figure, which has really been part of the problem with the Republicans on Capitol Hill. You know, I think privately, if you talk to them, they recognize that a lot of the things that he says and does are so unorthodox, and really is creating problems, maybe not with their base, with their Republican voters or Republican primary voters, but with independents and swing voters, and they're really nervous about this fall's elections. But he remains very popular with their base primary voters. And so they're just so reluctant to say anything. And only really until this press conference Monday, you start to see, just this morning, there was a story in The Hill, you know, where GOP seeks separation from Trump on Russia, and you have a series of bipartisan measures with Democratic and Republican U.S. senators that are being proposed in Congress dealing with Russia and foreign affairs that I think that they're starting to see, okay, I mean, we've got to do something here because, you know, I think that even the Republicans on Capitol Hill are starting to see that this is going to cause them problems.
Well, in the Southeastern Conference, the president carried all 11 states, and he remains popular in the states of the SEC, including Louisiana. And you don't hear John Bel Edwards saying a whole lot of negative things about President Trump either, although yesterday on his show he did criticize the president for the tariffs that are now being imposed, saying it could be an impediment to the Louisiana economy and a big impediment. But the criticism has been very gentle, and where is Bill Cassidy? I haven't heard him. These politicians who quite often get down in the weeds and, as I said, even call for the firing of an employee at Southern University on the biggest office in the land, one that they are certainly familiar with as U.S. senators, there is largely no call at all for any kind of change of course.
That's true. I mean, I think that you'll see the governor tries to work in a bipartisan manner, whether it's here in the state or on a federal level. That's just the way he operates.
877-217-5757 is your number. We'll return with Trey Orso after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. For Trey Orso is here with us for a little while longer, prominent Democratic political consultant in a solidly red state. John Bel Edwards yesterday, as he was preparing to do his radio show, was accosted by some members of the Bayou Bridge protest unit who were out in the lobby trying to prevent him from doing his show. 877-217-5757. And the governor, by the way, is one of only 16 Democratic governors in the United States of America. 16. And he's the only one in the Deep South. Andy on Goodwood. Andy, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Trey. Good morning. How can you explain? There was a poll I read in the paper in The Hill or Politico this morning amongst GOP voters. How can the GOP, the party of patriots, 70% of them, or nearly 70% of them, agree with Trump on his stance with Russia? How in the world can a reasonable person justify this? Just a comment and see what you guys have to say about it. Thank you.
Well, that's a fair question. Since I don't agree with them, it's hard for me to explain it for them. but I will say that, you know, the country is very polarized. As you know, partisanship is mm-hmm. in. And I was talking about it before the break. The president is a very polarizing person, and we've seen the Republican Party give this president passes on quite a few issues that traditionally they would not. I mean, you know, Tony Perkins a while back was on a cable news network, and they were talking about the Stormy Daniels thing, and he said, "Well, we're going to give him a mulligan." And they said, "Well, you're the head of the Family Research Council, you know, values." And mm-hmm. Perkins said, "Well, as long as he's promoting our conservative agenda, you know, that happened before he was president. We're going to give him a mulligan." And I almost fell out of my chair when I saw that. And I'm thinking, you know, it's like, you know, the world's upside down. And so your question is right. I mean, when you mm-hmm. see a Republican president stand next to the president of Russia, who everyone knows, you know, we don't suppose, we know, ordered interference with our elections, with our democracy. I wish they would quit saying that they hacked the Democratic server. I wish they would just say that they hacked American servers, because, I mean, it makes it like it's a partisan issue. It really didn't matter what party they hacked. I mean, in other words, you know, would the Republicans be upset about it if they had hacked a Republican server? Would it be bad then?
Well, Trey, yeah. I have no doubt that if President Trump were a Democrat, these Republicans who are now praising him would be all over him. But on the other hand, it were the other way around, would Democrats be defending the president? Would they be doing what Republicans are doing? Because we live in this partisan era, and we tend to often look at things differently based on our political viewpoints.
I think that's a fair question, and I was talking to somebody about it yesterday. As a person who, you know, works in politics and represents clients for a living, you know, we often have to put a certain amount of spin on issues and you know, certain circumstances that arise, and that's part of the business that we're in. But at some point, you know, at some point you got to get up in the morning and look yourself in the mirror and say, you know, how much of this can I do and how far can I go with this? And when your president stands there and capitulates the way it appeared that it happened on Monday, it really calls it into question.
Nick in College Town. Hi, Nick. You're on Talk Louisiana with Trey Orso.
Good morning, Jim. Good to hear you and Trey on this morning. I have a little bit of offbeat question for Trey. Trey, the speckled trout this weekend, how are they looking down on the coast? Are you going down there?
Well,
I recognize that voice too.
I'd love to go, and I'm kind of planning on trying to get down there Friday night, but the wind forecast looks really rough for Saturday. So the speckled trout forecast for this weekend looks really rough. I'm thinking it might be more of a redfish in the marsh type weekend.
Have you seen the president fishing or hunting any times lately? I see him golfing quite a bit, but
I don't know that the president
not a rugged outdoorsman like you and Nick.
Does much fishing and hunting. I think the president, his sons might like to do that big game hunting over there, safari type stuff. But I don't know that the president has much time for fishing and hunting.
Okay, David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Trey, you're making me homesick for Louisiana. As the person who won the City Park Big Bass Rodeo in 1960 in New Orleans, living in Atlanta, I sure miss what you're talking about. You know, Senator Ben Sasse was on one of the networks a short time ago from Nebraska, the Republican, and he's talking about bankruptcies like never seen before in his state because of this unnecessary trade war Trump is starting with China. Nebraska grows more agricultural products than the nation can even come close to consuming. And I would think that could maybe, hopefully, turn a red state into a blue state, or there'll be a lot of people in Nebraska applying for food stamps.
Well, we have the luxury, our firm, of working all over the country in different states.
By the way, is Sasse seeking reelection? I don't think he is. It seems like these Republicans who are not seeking reelection, like Corker and Flake,
speak out a little bit.
They speak
more
out a
freely.
Lot more. And right. McCain, of course, who won't be running again. Right. Yeah, but those who have other political aspirations, totally different perspective and
that's right.
The way they do this.
But we're working all over the country in various states, and you see that the tariffs are becoming a really big issue. There was a story in Bloomberg, I believe, a couple of weeks ago, that said that they thought that Louisiana could be impacted more than any other state by the Trump tariffs. And that is primarily because not only are we a huge agriculture state, but because we have the largest system of ports in the country, you know, between Baton Rouge and the Port of South Louisiana and then the Port of New Orleans. We have a huge port system. And so I think that's why you might have mentioned the governor was alluding to it on your show yesterday. I mean, there's a real concern that these tariffs and a trade war with China and other countries could have a detrimental impact on the economic recovery that we're seeing here in Louisiana as far as our unemployment rate going down and economic development and LNG investment in Southwest Louisiana. And so it's a serious issue that's not just here in Louisiana, but it's all over the country.
I mentioned Trey handles a lot of national candidates as well. Bud on Drusilla asks whether the president should discount Joe Biden as he did on NPR this morning, the story that ran with the president speaking, saying he would whip Joe Biden rather easily in 2020, that he looked forward to a race with Biden if it turns out to be a matchup between the then 78-year-old Biden and 74-year-old Trump. What do you think?
I don't think that the president should discount anybody, but at the same time, I'll never say never again. So I don't think that the Democrats, you know, should say, "Oh, we're just going to walk right in and beat this guy." I mean, President Trump's problem electorally right now is that, as I mentioned before, he is still very popular among Republican voters, but he is very, very unpopular among Democrats and independents. And so it's going to be, you know, he's got to do something different to at least get
or get a wounded candidate to run against him as he did last time.
To get the independents back. And thus far, he has not indicated in any way, shape, or form that he's going to change or do anything different about his habits.
Well, we're sorry we didn't make contact. We did make contact, but Scott McKay opted out today. But hopefully we'll have him on soon. Thank you, Trey Orso. And we'll be back with Mark Ambinder after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. And we're joined by Mark Ambinder. He is a highly regarded reporter, a DuPont Award-winning television producer, and a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications and Journalism. He was a White House correspondent for National Journal, and his book is President Reagan and the Nuclear War Scare of 1983. 35 years ago, the Cold War was in full bloom, and of course President Reagan was talking belligerently about the Soviet Union, and there are reports now that are certainly unveiled in this book in great detail showing that the United States, as in 1962, was on the brink of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. How close were we, Mark Ambinder?
Well, we were pretty close. And let me very briefly sketch out the closest point when we were on the brink. It probably was November 8th, 1983, right in the middle of this NATO exercise, right at the point where the U.S. was rehearsing, transferring its nuclear warheads to the West Germans, and that was part of what the exercise was about. But at that moment, unbeknownst to them, all across the Soviet Union, KGB officers were down in missile bunkers with keys ready to turn to launch ICBMs, and in the field, mobile ICBM regiments were on three-minute alerts, and if you were training in any Soviet military academy, you were confined to base. The reason was, if you asked, was because, well, NATO was holding an exercise that might turn into war. And what we know is that the U.S. and NATO didn't know about all these Russian and Soviet preparations, which means that the Soviets were truly afraid of something, because if they were just posturing, and there was a lot of posturing during that period on both sides, but if they were just posturing, well, the West would have known about it at the time, but the West didn't. And so I would say we were pretty close, and that was the moment where we were the closest.
Why was the Soviet Union so concerned about this prospect?
You know, on a 30,000-foot level, they were spending 70% of their gross domestic product on defense, and they were an empire on the decline, very clearly. And you look across the ocean and you have an optimistic president who represents a political philosophy that they were very unfamiliar with, who had just endorsed an enormous package of of new defense spending, and then a nuclear doctrine that seemed to suggest that, well, the United States could actually fight one of these nuclear wars, and it wouldn't result in the omnicide, in mutually assured destruction. And at the same time, you had spies telling you that the U.S. was working on all sorts of secret programs to decapitate the Soviet Union. You had very aggressive psychological warfare that the U.S. Navy was doing to literally, as the Secretary of the Navy at the time admitted, make the Russians more nervous. And it just catapults you into this psychological period or sense that your adversaries are about to do something very rash, and so you interpret things through that lens, and you look for signs and signals, and we know from confirmation bias, if you look for something like that, you're probably going to find it.
The president, Ronald Reagan, ultimately met with high-ranking members of the Soviet Union, including a former KGB spy. Was his belligerence and bellicose nature, was that an asset, or did it set things back? What will history tell regarding how the president handled the intense rivalry and hostility between the United States and the Soviet Union at that time?
At the beginning, it definitely set back relations. And his mistrust of the Soviet Union was not helpful. But to Reagan's enduring credit, and he does not get the credit for this particular presidential quality that I think he deserves. Once he was appraised of the intelligence showing that the Soviets were genuinely afraid, he undertook upon himself a crash course in trying to figure out exactly what it was the Soviets were afraid of. He modulated his rhetoric. He ordered an end to these provocative exercises. He met with dozens of people, read dozens of books, and extended a degree of empathy to what the Soviets must be feeling at the moment that people don't give him credit for. And he determined that regardless of whether the Soviet leaders, and remember, this was a period where three of them died in a period of 3 years, he was going to start meeting with Soviet leaders, talking with them one-on-one, and reducing, ultimately, the high-stakes tension that any sort of nuclear conflict might produce. So he certainly contributed to the tensions. But in the end, his empathy and his willingness to be humble about what he didn't know, not something that people think of when they think of President Reagan, but those qualities helped secure a lasting peace and reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the world, which ultimately is the lasting accomplishment.
The book is The Brink, President Reagan and the Nuclear War Scare of 1983, from Mark M. Binder. Mark, you noted the constant turnover in Soviet leadership at that time. Did the U.S. and President Reagan benefit from that?
I think it was to a collective detriment, because Reagan would have probably spoken with Soviet leaders earlier had they, as he put it, not kept dying on me. The old guard of the Soviet Union mistrusted Reagan significantly. They were military men primarily, and they weren't, unlike Mikhail Gorbachev, technocrats who were young enough to appreciate that the Soviet Union itself had a strong future. So that, simply the contingencies of history and very old Soviet leaders thinking about their own mortality, was a step against the prospect of peace. And it did take someone like Mikhail Gorbachev to recognize the benefits of truly sitting down with an American president and talking.
Are there lessons then that are applicable now?
The primary lesson is the nuclear command and control system, as it existed in 1983 and as it exists now, is certainly, it's a system built by mankind, but it is a system that is biased towards action and against deliberation, and that can be a big problem. We still have extremely a short amount of time for a president to decide if there's any sort of indication of a nuclear strike incoming. And the preference in the war plans that we have is just a spasm attack that would kill billions. There's a lot of things that collectively and technologically and with treaties that countries that are nuclear powers could do to reduce the risk of annihilation that they haven't done, because the technology is never going to be perfect. It's going to be 10 years behind what adversaries are going to be able to do to spoof the other side. So one lesson is, and not just, look, choosing presidents with temperaments that are congenial to weapons of this destructive capacity, but also taking a very serious look at all the assumptions that go into this system. Even basic questions is, how do we modernize our warheads? Do we need to modernize our warheads? Because if we reduce the number of our warheads, we think that's good. But if we make our current arsenal five times deadlier, have we really accomplished anything? So that's this problem, and this man-made problem exists today. There are things we can do about it. We need to pay a lot more attention to it.
What's the closest call we've had as far as a nuclear exchange?
I still say it's the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the more we learn about the Cuban Missile Crisis in history, we learn very scary things. We learn, for example, that for a period of time, Fidel Castro, who advocated actually using nuclear weapons against the United States, had in his possession short-range launchers. I think they were called Frog in the parlance of the time, they were called Frog launchers that U.S. intelligence didn't know about until 30 years later. And he controlled the missiles and was begging Khrushchev for the permission to launch them without our knowledge. And there were many close calls, and the defense condition level was raised to a point where we were on the verge. Again, if you think about this nuclear system, it's a system where the president serves as not a finger on a button or a finger on a trigger, but as a safety catch, because it's designed to go off. But when it comes to accidental nuclear war, I would say the events of 1983, the events I talk about, are probably the closest. But overall, the Cuban Missile Crisis is a sui generis conflict. It really, the more we learn about it, the more we realize, wow, there, but for the grace of whomever or whatever.
The book is The Brink, President Reagan and the Nuclear War Scare of 1983, from Mark Ambinder. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, sir.
And coming next, we'll hear from Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief from The Advocate. We'll talk with him about the qualifying for the Secretary of State election. The successor to Tom Shedler will be chosen by voters this fall, and hopefully the turnout will be stronger than it was for the race to succeed John Kennedy as treasurer. Fewer than 20% of the registered voters cast ballots in that election last year. There's also a big decision on the Metro Council as Denise Amoroso, the widow of Buddy Amoroso, seeks to succeed her late husband on the council, a tradition that's been in place, but there are some Democrats who say that this is not something that's certainly in a statute, and they would prefer the governor to name the successor to Buddy Amoroso. We'll talk about that. And yesterday, speaking of the governor, he had to battle to get his way into the studio because of Bayou Bridge protesters who were congregated in our lobby. We'll talk about that as well when we return after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar are producing, and our guest is Mark Ballard, the Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. And we're going to cover some ground with Mark. If you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. Mark, first of all, the Secretary of State qualifying is ongoing, and what's the field look like to succeed Tom Shedler and the interim person, Kyle Ardoin?
Well, despite the beginning of it, at the beginning, we may have had two dozen people saying they were interested, and it looks right now like it's just going to be four. We have a Democrat, Renee Fontenot-Free, who had worked with the Secretary of State's office under Fox McKithen and now later. We have Julie Stokes, who's a kind of a moderate Republican from Kenner, a CPA, and has been a thorn in the sides of the more right-wing House members because she keeps bringing up these kind of factual numbers based on what their thoughts on taxes and the impact is going to be. Then you have two very conservative candidates. One is Rick Edmonds from the House. He's one of the members of the Gang of No and is a very conservative candidate. And then you have A.G. Crow, who was a former state senator of also very conservative, was one of the in the forefront in trying to do away with Common Core and many of those kind of issues as well. So it looks like two very conservatives, a moderate Republican, and a Democrat.
All right, 877-217-5757, and also talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to send us an email. And a listener notes that Rick Edmonds, one of the candidates you just mentioned, a local person here, has signed a 10-point pledge with Louisiana voters. And I'm actually pulling up the pledge. And the, for example, to exercise the moral courage to hold himself and others accountable for their actions, to avoid impropriety and refrain from misusing an official position to secure unwarranted privileges or advantages for himself or others. It goes on from there. This is more of an ethical thing, much of which, of course, is not involved directly in the office of the Secretary of State. But as you noted, Representative Edmonds is a very devout man.
He is, yeah, I would never question any of his ethics. He does have very conservative political views, but he holds them honestly and I don't think we'll be finding that kind of a fight going on.
877-217-5757 for Mark Ballard. And we're, as I stated, we're going to cover some ground. Front page story today from Elizabeth Crisp, and the governor reflected on this yesterday on his monthly radio show. Attorney General Jeff Landry is blaming the governor for a halt in executions. Now, Mark, I don't think we've had but two executions in this state in the 21st century. Is Governor Edwards responsible for this?
No. I mean, I think that it's very clearly a sop to the political base of Jeff Landry in making an attack on the governor like this. We've run into this problem in that that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies refuse to sell the drugs that are necessary to execute prisoners. And this state's law says that you will do it by lethal injection, so that if we want to execute by another means, which is you have to pass the law to do so, you know, if you would prefer to hang them or shoot them or something like that, it's they legally can't do that, and the legislature has been unwilling to do something like that. They've also been unwilling to just do away with the death penalty. The state's death penalty or capital punishment scheme has got many flaws in it, and it's going to have to, it will require significant legislative changes. What this judge did a couple of days ago was basically say, you know, okay, let's put it on hold for a while until we can figure out how we're going to go about doing it.
Now, yesterday, the governor covered a lot of ground on his radio show, but as he was heading to the studio, Mark, he was confronted by, I would say, about 50 Bayou Bridge protesters who were in the lobby of our building. And one of them actually physically shoved the governor as he was entering the studio. As you can imagine, there was a show of force by law enforcement, and some people were arrested, I'm told. But this Bayou Bridge thing is interesting in that these are people on the left side of the political spectrum who are attacking the governor.
Right. I think that too often we kind of label, and I don't think that the governor is as far left as the folks on the far right would like to label him. He's far more moderate on it, and he has backed this pipeline, saying that it's a safer way to transport the crude across the state rather than doing it in trucks and that sort of thing. There are concerns that on the other side that it's going to disrupt the environment, and that if there is a break in the pipeline, it'll destroy a lot of our swamps. So it's a very touchy subject.
Tonight, the Metro Council in Baton Rouge will decide on Buddy Amoroso's seat. Councilman Amoroso died a little less than 3 weeks ago in a tragic bicycling crash, of which he was not responsible, in St. Francisville. His widow, Denise Amoroso, wants the seat. It's been a tradition in Baton Rouge that this happens, but there apparently is going to be some pushback. The four Democrats, Shauna Banks, Lamont Cole, Donna Collins-Lewis, and Erica Green, have remained silent, but they had indicated they would not vote. And Tara Wicker was on this show saying she would vote for Denise Amoroso. So if she does, then it's going to be a settled deal. But nonetheless, this has created some tension on the council.
I think there was tension on the council before then. I mean, we're a very politically divided city and parish. And that shows up on the Metro Council. It showed up with Buddy Amoroso in particular. He was a very conservative council member. And I think there's a little power play going on here to see who has the most power.
Now, a listener asked, this is Tracy at the Capitol, asking if Denise Amoroso is approved as expected, does that mean that if something, heaven forbid, were to happen to Mayor Broome, that her husband would succeed her? Would the Republican majority on the council be in favor of that?
Entertaining thought, but I believe that the law has it that the chairman of the council would succeed the.
I think that is it. But if it's,
I see her point.
Yeah. This has caused some grief, and we'll see what happens. But I know some people have been working Tara Wicker, trying to get her to change her mind. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. But Denise Amoroso is a very eloquent lady and certainly has shown great bravery and integrity after the death of her husband. But others say that, look, when Buddy Amoroso himself was on the council, he tried to get a Republican to replace Denise Marcel on the council after she was elected to the state house. So he, in essence, violated the same tradition himself. That's what they say.
Well, as I say, I mean, it is a very divisive council that kind of reflects the divisiveness in this community. And what we're seeing are power plays to try to sway the council one way or the other.
Louisiana lawmakers, Mark, front page story below the fold, lead GOP effort to support ICE. That's the GOP lawmakers leading the charge on Capitol Hill to express support for immigration and customs enforcement agencies. What's going on here?
Well, particularly after what happened along the Texas border with the separating the families, there's been a movement afoot to try to do away with the immigration control, and that's what this is kind of a reflection of. The Republicans were saying, you know, well, we wanted to show our support, though this particular bill was not necessarily that. It didn't really do anything other than to kind of rally support, as I believe the Democrats in Congress didn't. You know, they just voted present so that they didn't have to weigh in on the issue at all.
Well, getting back to the Secretary of State election, a listener picked up on what I said. I said fewer than 20% of the voters showed up for the treasurer's race. I think it might have even been less than 15%. Is there any indication at all that it will be different this year?
You know, I would say that I think it was about 13%, frankly, but that showed up for the actual runoff that elected the treasurer. I think we're going to see more voters, but it's going to be a very low turnout election. What you have are this time around that we didn't have the last time. Last time we had the mayor's race in New Orleans. This time you have congressional races. If all six seats are up for the House of Representatives, and only one of them is going to be competitive in any way, and the rest of them are going to be pretty much slam dunks. And so we will have, on a national level, there'll be there's an effort, there's a possibility that the Democrats could take control of the House, and so on a national level, there's going to be a lot more media attention to these elections, though it's not really going to make an impact in Louisiana, other than it will remind voters that there's an election coming up. So I think it'll be a low turnout election. 80% of the folks don't know who the Secretary of State is, but it won't be a big election.
Well, thank you, Mark Mallard. We hopefully will hear from you again next week. It's always good to talk with you.
Enjoy it. Thank you, sir.
See you. And for Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, I'm Jim Engster. We're back tomorrow. One of our guests is slated to be Greg Merriweather, the anchor for Channel 9, the former Street Beat reporter. He'll talk about what's going on in our world, and we'll be back. Hope you'll be with us. Till tomorrow, stay tuned.